As many of you may know, I have a visceral sense that we did not attack ourselves, that we did not plan and execute an attack, killing our own citizens. And I very nearly, just as strongly, believe that what's being presented to me right now is completely flawed. I refuse to believe, on the one hand, that we would not tell our people, that our president would not tell our people about concrete evidence, if it was in trainers or where they were trained or anything else that connected Iraq to 9/11, that we wouldn't tell the country about that. Indeed, along with that, I have a more than difficult time believing that the two leaders of the free world in this country and Great Britain, where my guest is from, would use WMDs as weapons of mass destruction as the excuse for going into Iraq, not using 9/11, which he claims should have been used, but instead use WMDs, which he claims we had intelligence that had already been moved out. In other words, they would be ending up immediately, and they would know they'd end up with eggs on their faces. It just, none of it makes any sense to me, but we'll try again with Michael Shrimpton in a moment. Well, all right, Michael, let's try one more time here. Again, as I mentioned, I have a visceral feeling that we did not attack ourselves. However,
that's correct.
What you're telling me is every bit, if not more, difficult to buy because of the fact that we really, really needed a good reason to attack Iraq, and you're saying we had one and didn't use it, and you have not explained to me why we didn't use it.
I know it's difficult to buy, but that is what happened. A lot of things which are true are difficult to buy. But just because it's not easy to buy, it doesn't mean to say it isn't true.
In good, simple English, without going back to the Germans in World War II, try and tell me, what pressure could have been brought to bear on our president not to use the truth?
Financial pressure. You've got China with $1 trillion worth of T-bills. So enormous pressure from China.
All right, suggesting China was blackmailing the president, the USA?
Absolutely. Over the last 3 to 4 years, there has been heavy economic pressure by China applied behind the scenes on the U.S. dollar. And you can track senior U.S. officials, Treasury Secretary Paulson, Alan Greenspan, when he was chairman of the Federal Reserve, going over to China. The Clinton administration really set you guys up. Mm. The whole business of giving China virtually unfettered access to U.S. markets. China's building up a massive U.S. foreign exchange surpluses, U.S. dollar surpluses, has created a massive rod for the administration's back. It is very, very difficult for the United States to move unless and until that $1 trillion worth of T-bills sitting in China's reserves is taken out or somehow dealt with. Until you guys can park that one T and lift the threat to the dollar, it is very, very difficult for America to act with complete freedom. Now, we had the same problem when the pound was under tremendous attack during the Suez Crisis.
Why would the Chinese care whether or not we blame 9/11 on Iraq
But Bin Laden was Bin Laden was in China. In November 2001, Bin Laden goes into China. Yes. And the Chinese are very, very close to the Pakistan Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, which in turn is very, very close to al-Qaeda. China, People's Republic of China, is a strategic competitor for the United States. Mm. The Chinese knew about 9/11 in advance. The Pakistan nuclear weapons are supplied by China. That's Chinese technology. And we know that there were Chinese nuclear technicians servicing Pakistan's nukes, bringing them up to full operational status in the months running up to 9/11. There were Chinese technicians crawling all over.
Okay, let's say I bought that. Let's say I bought that, Michael, at face values. You've yet to answer why China would particularly care enough to essentially blackmail the U.S. administration into not blaming Iraq for its involvement in 9/11.
Well, China would absolutely not want the U.S. China certainly did not want President Bush to win in 2004. China has been working against British and American interests in the Middle East right from 9/11, indeed from before. If you think about Bin Laden goes over the Kunjarab Pass about November 2001. Bin Laden goes across the Kunjarab Pass between Pakistan and China in a convoy of Toyota Land Cruisers. They were playing the shell game, switching him from one Land Cruiser to another, just in case you guys picked him up. Now, China actually sheltered Bin Laden, and it's only after some months, early 2002, that we have Bin Laden moving back into Pakistan. So you've got the Chinese working against you and against us. You've got the Chinese working very closely with the French and the Germans. And
okay, but Michael, you still are not answering my question. Why would China use economic blackmail to prevent the U.S. administration from putting the blame where it should be? Why?
Because China wants Iraq, because China wants the West to fail, and China particularly wants the West to fail in Iraq at the moment. Now, the minute Britain and America get the truth about Iraqi involvement in 9/11 and get the intelligence about Iraq's connections to al-Qaeda out into the open, public support for the war in Iraq surges inevitably. That is why we went to war.
Which would be a goal of the administration, yours and ours.
Exactly. But think about the politics of it. The politics of that mean almost certainly a Republican victory in 2008, and that is not what the Chinese want. In the United Kingdom terms, the Chinese are much happier with Blair where he is at the moment. They do not want Gordon Brown to come in to take over from Tony Blair. The Chinese most certainly do not want the UK moving further away from the EU, which is what a Brown government would mean. So China's strategic interest is best served by tying Britain and America up in knots over Iraq, by making sure that public support, insofar as they can do it, public support for US and UK involvement in Iraq drains away. And this has happened before. Look at Vietnam. Think back to how difficult it was for the Johnson administration and then the Nixon administration to make the case for war in Vietnam, to explain to the American people why you guys were there, what you were doing, to actually carry out an effective military strategy. You guys knew how to win the Vietnam War. American military leaders are not stupid. I've never met an American 4-star or 3-star general or admiral who I thought was even remotely stupid. You guys, General Westmoreland was a very fine general. You guys knew how to win Nam, but you couldn't do it. And the reasons lie in Washington. And
You'll get no argument there from me, but I.
We're the same over Iraq. We're having the same difficulties. It is much more difficult than you might suppose with respect for the Bush administration to follow a policy which is in its own interests and which is in America's interests. The pressures on the administration are far greater than the U.S. public would understand. $1 trillion of the T-bills is one factor. It's not the only factor, but it is an enormously powerful factor because in practice, if the administration started doing what the People's Republic of China did not see was in its strategic interest, then the dollar could go. I mean, the $1 trillion worth of T-bills gives the Chinese enormous economic leverage, and that is not the Bush administration's fault. That is the fault of letting China into the WTO and giving China favored nation access to U.S. markets and allowing a huge trade imbalance to build up between the United States and China. And where you have where your country's currency is at risk, the practical constraints on policymakers are considerable. We have had that problem in the U.K. We had to abandon our Middle East policy in the mid-1950s because of constraints on the currency. And we had Harold Macmillan, the Chancellor, working closely with the Dulles brothers in Washington, and the British government collapsed, and we pulled out of Suez. Well, it was deeply in our strategic interest to carry on with the Suez invasion in 1956.
So essentially, you're telling me the Chinese essentially blackmailed us, told us that, look, if you tell the truth about Iraq's involvement in 9/11, we're going to pull these bills. We're going to drive the dollar into the ground and economically ruin you. Is that correct?
That is in summary. Yeah, it doesn't happen exactly like that. Somebody in China doesn't get on the phone to Washington and said, if you do that, then we will do this. Pressure is applied internationally a little more subtly than that. But that's the long and short of it. Take for example towards the end of 2006. the Chinese suddenly started dumping large numbers of T-bills. And that was done in an attempt to apply pressure to the administration. And what happens is that you then get Federal Reserve officials going across to Beijing, you get carve-ups, and there is then effectively a Chinese input into policy. Now, we have the same problem with the French and the Germans. We, as we're in the EU, we have been under enormous political pressure from the French and the Germans. There's no way Tony Blair was ever going to make the case linking Iraq to 9/11 whilst Britain was in the European Union, whilst he was close to the French and the Germans, and whilst French and German strategic interests were allied with China against the UK and the US. The geopolitics of 9/11 are such that it has been very, very difficult for either the administration or the British government to get out there, tell the truth, and explain to the British and American public who have a need to know why we are in Iraq. If you think about WMDs, WMDs cannot have been the reason. We know there were WMDs in Iraq. I mean, everybody agreed there were WMD programs in Iraq. The UN agreed, the French, the Germans agreed. Nobody disputed in the 1990s, seriously disputed, that Iraq had WMD programs. The Iraqis actually used WMDs. I mean, it's not that these were test or research programs. The Iraqis used WMDs on their own people. Talabja, for example.
No,
now, where did all those weapons go? They weren't
Yes. But you're telling me at the same time we had intelligence that they were already gone at the time we were saying we're going to war because of the WMDs.
Yeah, you guys are watching them. You guys have satellites over there. That railroad line between Baghdad and Damascus wasn't open for the Syria-Iraq tourist traffic.
No politician, Michael, wants that, you know, would voluntarily toss that much egg on their own faces.
Well, good question. But then you've got to come back to this huge split in the Bush administration between supporters of the elected president and supporters of his father. President Bush Sr. carries far more bureaucratic weight in Washington than the American people would suppose. He carries enormous clout, and the president has been struggling from the whole of his two terms to emerge from behind his father's shadow. Remember, his father made the mistake in 1991 of not going into Baghdad. We could have sorted this whole mess out March of 1991 and gone straight on into Baghdad. And the President Bush, the current President Bush, has had to deal with a mess that was handed down to him by his father and has had to deal with that against a background of this enormous Chinese U.S. dollar surplus built up thanks to the Clinton administration trade policies. The thing about the U.S. media, the U.S. media has been working, the mainstream media has been working against the administration almost solidly since 9/11. There was a honeymoon period immediately after 9/11. But you've got, the president's got the media working against him. He's got enormous economic pressures from China. He's got enormous bureaucratic pressures from his old man, with respect. He has got huge problems with his intelligence community. He's got huge problems with the State Department. And he has to carry allies with him. Now, the British have been a break on this. It's been enormously frustrating for those of us in the over here in the UK to see Tony Blair acting effectively as a break on the administration. In practice, the administration would not have gone it alone in using 9/11 as the casus belli for war with Iraq. The administration wanted to form a common policy with allies. The most important ally was the UK. And for political reasons, Tony Blair was absolutely insistent that we go with WMDs. And Blair must have known the political problems he was creating for himself. But nevertheless, the pressures on him from France and Germany were so strong that he's had to go with WMDs as the case for war. And I have no doubt that Blair knew what he was doing to his own government. President Bush, I think that President Bush had much less access to the intelligence on WMD shipments out of Iraq than you might suppose. I doubt very much whether anybody went to President Bush and said in the run-up to the Iraq war, Mr. President, here are the satellite photographs of trucks and railroad cars leaving Iraq, going into Syria, and we think the Iraqis are shipping out their WMDs. To prove my point, look at the plane case and the difficulty the president had is making the case for Iraq's attempt to purchase yellow cake in Niger. Now, we know over here that Iraq definitely wanted to acquire uranium yellowcake from Niger. It makes sense. Niger is very close to France. Saddam Hussein was very close to Jacques Chirac and France and Germany. France and Germany sit behind Iraq, or did, when Saddam Hussein was in power. Niger is very close to France. It's effectively a French client state. It's the major French-controlled source of uranium. It is the obvious place for Iraq to go to acquire uranium. So the Iraqis make soundings in Niger. We want uranium yellowcake. British intelligence picked that up. There is an accurate report from MI6. It's shared with you guys. The president puts it in his State of the Union address. And what happens? We have Italian intelligence working with Italian media, slipping out these bogus documents saying the same thing as the real intelligence did. That real intelligence is thereby discredited, and the whole of the US media, virtually across the spectrum, the US and UK media, jump on President Bush, make it absolutely clear that this intelligence was wrong when it wasn't. Don't pause for a moment. I don't think any Western journalist has paused for even 5 minutes to ask himself or herself a basic question. Hang on a minute. If these second set of documents are forged, why are we saying the first set of documents are forged? It doesn't necessarily follow. One set's forged doesn't mean to say other documents have been forged. And then you have the Valerie Plame nonsense in Washington. Everybody in the intelligence community who's got any serious connections whatsoever knows that Valerie Plame was not covert. She was never protected by the Intelligence Identities Protection Act from about 1992. I haven't spoken to anybody in the intelligence community who worked with Valerie Plame or knew of her doing covert activity any time after about 1992. The whole case has been a joke. But have the administration been able to get their case across? No chance. That whole trial has proceeded on a completely false basis, an entirely unfair conviction against Libby. Louis Libby, I've never met him. I have no brief for Louis Libby, but as far as I'm concerned, he's probably a good man, certainly innocent of the charges brought against him, and the administration absolutely powerless spectators. And they know this. I mean, I have been to the White House. I've been to Washington. I've sat down with senior administration officials. It's so difficult that if you go to the White House to talk about the Valerie Plame case, what will normally happen is you go out of the building, you go down, you head for the nearest Starbucks, and you have the serious discussion in Starbucks, because inside the building there are too many people working against the president. I've had the experience of passing vital intelligence onto the White House, and it gets diverted. I tried to brief in Karl Rove's office, for example, to take a practical example of how difficult it is for the president. I had intelligence supplied to me by the UK from a senior intelligence source about Valerie Plame not being covert, and intelligence about links between certain prosecutors on the case. I won't mention names on a public radio broadcast in the States, but intelligence causing major concern in London about links between some of the prosecutors working on that case and some bad guys inside the US intelligence community who it is known were not working for Uncle Sam, who it is known were reporting to the German DVD in Dhaka. And that fairly critical intelligence was taken by me to Washington on a back-channel basis. I had tried to get it via an encrypted email into Karl Rove, and it took weeks and weeks and weeks, and every message was diverted. And I found I would ring up or send an email to somebody in Karl Rove's office, whose name I had, and say, please pass this on to Mr. Rove, and I'd follow up and find it had been diverted to the National Security Council. Then it gets diverted back down to Langley, and the intelligence just goes walkies. It is formidably difficult.
All right, Michael, we're not going to agree on how we got there and the politics that got us in and all the rest of it, but we are there
now. We have to agree to differ on that one, huh?
I'm afraid so. Where are we with the Iraq war now? I mean, we can both look at the headlines and the daily news and know what's going on. So what I'd like to do is get your assessment of where we are now with Iraq, whether we're winning or losing. And there really are two giantly different schools on that thought. And also, I'd like to know what knowledge you have of Iran possessing nuclear weapons. So when we get back from the break, if you'll consider those two questions, we'll delve into them. And as you pointed out, we're going to have to agree to disagree on the rest of it because it crosses every boundary of common sense that I can construct, even when I want to think about conspiracies. the one that holds our president back from saying Iraq was connected intimately with 9/11, I just can't make that work. We'll be right back. All right, so in a moment, we'll ask Michael Shrimpton how the war with Iraq is proceeding, where it's going, whether we're winning, losing, or whether there's some kind of eternal deadly draw going on. And these days, to go to Iraq, you've got to certainly not be in fear of the Reaper. And also, what about Iran? The Russians said we were massing on the borders. We were getting ready to invade Iran, to take out their infrastructure, to... What's the expression, to decapitate the leadership, that sort of thing, all in one giant strike? Those questions coming up in a moment. All right, Michael, since we declared victory, since that period of time until the present moment, what is your assessment of where we are in the war with Iraq? Where are we now? Let's begin there.
Well, we are in a mess, Art, and we're heading for a Vietnam-style stalemate. The problem is that we're in a war with a U.S. administration split, as it was during Nam. We have a British government that is not fully committed, and with a lack of clear political direction at the top, we are in trouble. Now, the president, God bless him, and I have a great admiration for your president, he has tried to address this, and the surge policy is the right policy. But just coming back to the points I was making earlier, look how difficult it has been in practice for the president to get that policy implemented. He's the president of the United States. He announces the policy. He has Congress jumping all over him. And Secretary Gates, no offense intended, Secretary Gates has actually been holding this policy back. The troop increase levels that the president announced have not actually taken place. So we have the right policy from the administration, but they're not allowed to implement it any more than President Johnson or President Nixon were effectively able to implement a sensible strategy over Vietnam. Now, we have to address the problems that there are in Washington. Somebody has to win that civil war in the administration between supporters of President Bush and supporters of his father. Somebody has to get the Chinese off the Americans' back. And we have to get the French and Germans off our back. We have to identify who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. The French, the Germans, and the Chinese are working against us and you guys. We need to get the British government fully committed to what we're doing in Iraq. And at some point, at some time, Art, it would be extremely helpful if somebody in London or Washington could go on television, as you suggest, and actually explain to the British and American people why our sons and daughters are dying in Iraq. In a democracy, this is a basic failure of intelligence here, in a democracy, the people have a right to know why we are going to war. It's basic first principle of intelligence, the need
Michael,
to know.
Michael, it's a failure of common sense if somebody bought into what you're saying. Now, with respect to where we go...
Politics.
Yeah, so where we're going from here, you say the current policy is all right, but the British aren't committed to it. So we're losing. Would you say we're losing? Would you say it's a draw currently? Ultimately, we can win if we stay committed. What are you saying?
We can win if we stay committed. At the moment, it's a draw. At the moment, we're losing casualties. There is a lack of clear political direction. The new U.S. commander, General Petraeus, seems to me to be very, very able. And I think if he gets the troop levels that he needs and the resources that he needs, then we will win. But we have to address the states which are sponsoring the terrorist insurgency inside Iraq. We have to get to grips with Syria, and we have to get to grips with Iran.
All right, let's talk about Iran for a moment. There were recent reports from Russia that the U.S. was massing forces and about to attack Iran. You're aware of those reports, I take it?
Yes, I've read them, and I don't agree with them. I'm not sure where the Russians are getting this from. It looks to me like someone has fed some false intelligence to the Russians, and that, I think, is coming out of the East Coast, and the Russians are circulating that. I think the Russians are circulating in good faith, but I think somebody is feeding some disinformation into the Russians. I check those reports out. There is absolutely no American plan to attack Iran at the moment. I think you should. I think we should. We should have stood up much more strongly to Iran over the hostage crisis that has just ended. Thankfully,
oh yes, oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm glad you mentioned it, Michael. The initial reaction to the hostages being taken by Iran, I thought, was very muted.
Correct.
And I expected a much, much bigger reaction. I expected perhaps even military action. So would it be your opinion that indeed they were in Iranian waters when they were picked up? What do you think about that?
No, I think the captain made it quite clear at the press conference yesterday that they were 1.7 nautical miles inside Iraqi territorial waters. I have absolutely no problem with that whatsoever. It's perfectly clear the Iranians came inside Iraqi territorial waters, seized our guys, and it's perfectly clear that that was planned.
All right, then the muted reaction to it.
Political problems again. The Blair government is not going to stand up to Iran. Tony Blair has been humiliated over this, and as with Iraq, he has allowed himself to be humiliated. And he's allowed himself to be humiliated because of the mess he's got himself into with the EU, France, and Germany. And that's why we need to get out of there, and we need to get a more serious figure in as Prime Minister. And
so you want the UK out of the EU?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, what's the point of dealing with your enemies? The French and Germans are not on our side. They're not on our side over Iraq. France and Germany, as I said, were behind Saddam Hussein. France and Germany, very close to Iran. Iran is almost a Franco-German client state. Another basic intelligence principle art is follow the money. Now, if you follow the money for the Iranian Revolution in 1979, it goes all the way back to Paris, and I suspect some of it goes further on from Paris into Munich and Dachau. That is why the October surprise meeting was cut. That deal was cut in Paris by First President Bush, not in Tehran. That is why the first meetings in the Iran-Contra affair, which, as it happens, was set up by a friend of mine, didn't know him at the time, got to know him many years later, that is why those negotiations were not initially conducted with the Iranians at all, but with the Germans. France takes its oil out of Iran at $12 a barrel. The oil price that we pay in Britain and you guys pay in the United States is basically a phony. Well, most oil, or a large chunk of the world's oil, is actually supplied in sweet deals to the French, the Chinese, and also the Germans at way below the so-called market rate. Now, the French get their oil out of Iran at $12 a barrel because they helped pay for the Iranian Revolution. Iran is not an independent state in the way that it likes to pretend that it is. Iran is very much dependent on France and Germany, and Iran's nuclear material is supplied mostly by the French, also to some extent by the Germans, and to some extent by the Chinese.
Do they already have the bomb?
Absolutely. What they have, the CIA and the IAEA, and I've been in a meeting where addressed by Mohammed El-Baradei, no offense intended, but he is useless. He's as much use as a... I'll refrain from using the expression, but he's not a lot of use.
Sounds like there's offense intended.
Yeah, he's useless. The UN is useless. The UN is certainly not on side. Mm-hmm. The concentration on Iran's enriched uranium program is an intelligence blind. Everybody's obsessing on enriched uranium weapons, whereas we all know that a plutonium warhead is more compact, and if you want to put a warhead on top of a fairly small German-supplied, Chinese-supplied rocket, and there are German rocket scientists in Iran as we speak, a lot of German technical assistance covertly to Iran, new torpedo, for example, German technical assistance on their submarines. I understand there are even German officers, German naval officers, helping to crew, i.e. command, Iranian submarines. The technical assistance getting to that level, down to the tactical as well as the strategic, but we have the plutonium warheads on these intended to go on the IRBMs, and the plutonium, the weapons-grade plutonium, is being supplied by France. Now, this is crazy. Absolute madness for the French to be supplying weapons-grade plutonium to the Iranians, but that is what they're doing. Now, the French have a covert stockpile of plutonium. The French have a very large domestic nuclear power program, and they have a thing called the fast breeder reactor, which is just perfect for plut. Now, the French have a lot of hot plut. They have a stockpile of it, Art. And this is covert. Now, how many kilos or how much hot plute has gone into Tehran? That's a matter for discussion. I understand the Iranians have between 4 and 5 plutonium warheads operational at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reasoning behind that was, and I had a recent discussion with a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. Now, you heard of those guys, very close to the Trilateral Commission, turned very close to Germany and France. And this guy was just grinning at me inanely when I was making the point. He wasn't even bothering to deny that France has supplied Iran with weapons-grade plutonium. He knew it was true. I knew it was true. And we both knew the other knew it was true.
Are you sure he wasn't simply humored by the premise?
No. The French strategy, the French and German strategy after 2003 was to equip Iran with nuclear weapons in the hope it would deter a British and American response against Iran in the same way that we attacked Iraq. Now, the French and Germans know that Iran is responsible for sponsoring a lot of the terrorism that is going down inside Iran. Terrorism does not just happen. Terrorism is almost always state-sponsored. And the Bush administration were right after 9/11 to look for which states were sponsoring that attack. It is almost impossible for a terrorist organization to mount a major attack without assistance from a state, and in particular that state's intelligence apparatus. Terrorism I define as state-sponsored asymmetric warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And the terrorist insurgency inside Iraq is being sponsored by Syria and Iran. Now, behind Syria and Iran, you have France, you have Germany, and you have China. You can trace this on the ground. I mean, the nuclear material is coming in from France. Some of it's coming from Germany. You've got Chinese technical assistance on Iran's IRBM program.
Yeah, none of this is too hard to buy.
No. Now, until we can deal with Iran and Syria, then we're not going to be able to stabilize Iraq. The Iranians have been inside Iraq, they've obviously had intelligence network inside Iraq for a long, long time, particularly mm-hmm. in the south. But the first major Iranian terrorist attack inside Iraq was the assassination of a moderate Shiite spiritual leader, Ayatollah al-Khoi, in, I think, June of 2003. And I have been saying since June of 2003 that attack, which was set up by the Iranian VVAC intelligence agency, indicated that Iran was pursuing a covert program of sponsoring terrorism inside Iraq. Until and unless we deal with Iran, and until and unless we deal with Syria, then we're not going to stabilize Iraq. Now, with the surge in troops, we are clearly going to at least hold the fort in Iraq. We were, until that surge, we were losing ground with that surge, albeit it's not been fully implemented. With that surge, partially implemented, we are holding ground in Iraq, but we will not start winning. We will not start, you know, the tipping point will not be reached until we get the Iranians and the Syrians out of there.
All right, Michael, if it were up to you, if you were in power, if you had some sort of ability to dictate a policy, how would you deal with Syria and Iran?
I would go to war with both. I would stop messing around. I would say, look, either we're going to win this war on terror, or we're going to lose it. We haven't got an option of not fighting it because the bad guys came to us. Let's go win it, and let's stop dragging it out for year after year. I would go big, and I would go quick, and I would go messy and dirty in the short term with a view to a much quicker victory than we're going to obtain by pursuing the current strategy, which is
and bearing in mind everything you've said about what you believe is behind this, how would you then deal with China?
Now, I would recognize Taiwan. Now, it's going to be a lot easier for Brits to do this than the Americans. If I had power as opposed to influence, and it's frustrating just having influence because you give the advice, it's not followed, and you just have to pick up the pieces after the advice is not followed. It's very frustrating. I would deal with China this way. I would pull the UK out of the EU, and I'd pull the UK out of the WTO. We don't need to be in the WTO. We can cut our own free trade deal with you guys. We can rejoin the European Free Trade Area, and we have the Commonwealth. And those are the only people, frankly, we need to deal with in terms of trade, plus the Russians and the Israelis and the Taiwanese. I would recognize Taiwan, which we can do, taking a lead. You guys cannot recognize Taiwan at the moment because the Chinese have too many U.S. dollar foreign exchange reserves. They have very few sterling reserves. So we recognize Taiwan, and we start to dismantle the WTO and start to attack China's economic growth. We try and slow it down.
What do you think the repercussions of Great Britain recognizing Taiwan? What would the repercussions be?
The repercussions would be nothing but good. It'd be great for the Taiwanese. It's something I've discussed with the Taiwanese. They would welcome it. It'd be great for UK balance of payments because we'd stop importing stuff from China. The Taiwanese are much more ready to buy British goods than the Chinese will be. We'd have a much fairer trading relationship. Chinese political pressure on the UK would be lifted almost at a stroke. We get Chinese intelligence, their intelligence station out of London. We get Chinese out of London. And we clear the way for the U.S. administration, maybe in 12, 18 months' time, to recognize Taiwan. At the same time, the U.K. needs to massively boost its defense spending. Now, the membership of the EU costs us around £3 billion, $5 to $6 billion a week. That's the total cost of the U.K. economy. It's massive. And these are the sums that come out of the British Treasury and the U.S. Treasury if you talk to them very, very quietly. Now, by pulling out of the EU, the U.K. is suddenly able, without increasing taxation, suddenly able to put our forces on a serious war-fighting level. At the moment, Britain and America are trying to fight a war with peacetime force levels. Well, that is a nonsense. We saw that in the Iranian hostage crisis. The only ship we had supporting our guys in the Shatt al-Arab waterway was a Type 22 frigate, HMS Cornwall, that was laid down in 1983 and went into service in 1988. She's nearly 20 years old. She was the wrong warship in the wrong place. She draws nearly 17 and a half feet. The ships that would have been used supporting our Marines and sailors are sitting up tied in a dockyard in Plymouth. Or Portsmouth, because we haven't got the money to put them into commission. That is just a nonsense art. We need to massively increase British defence spending. We need to get serious in the war on terror. We've got people on the ground who are very serious, but there are not enough of them. And pulling out of the EU is one means of giving us the resources that we need.
Okay, so you're saying you didn't respond to the the kidnappings because you couldn't.
Exactly. We were too weak. What we should have done is issued an ultimatum to Tehran saying, you return our people within 24 hours or we are at war.
What I would have expected.
Exactly. That is the proper British response. What we got was a weak response from Tony Blair, who allowed himself to be humiliated just as he allowed himself to be humiliated over Iraq and WMDs. And we need to get that weak leader out of Downing Street. I know he has a reputation in America as a strong leader, but that's based on rhetoric. Blair is great when it comes to strong rhetoric, but he's all talk, no action, and we saw that over Iran. Now, he's been completely humiliated, and the latest word is that he'll be on his way within weeks. And frankly, for us Brits, it just cannot come too soon.
Okay. Now, Osama bin Laden, where is he now? Do you know, and how do we get him?
Osama bin Laden, so far as I know, is still in an ISI safe house. It's an air-conditioned, quite comfortable safe house. And although I don't know his precise whereabouts at this time, and I wouldn't say so on an open broadcast if I did, to my understanding, he's around about 25 miles southeast of Peshawar in the northwest frontier area of Pakistan, probably somewhere between the towns of Noshera and Sherat, Noshera, N-O-W-S-H-E-R-A, and Sherat, C-H-E-R-A-T. Now, you guys know where he is, because you guys have got a bird overhead, and you guys have been tracking his movements for some considerable time. So have we. The problem with going after bin Laden is that he is surrounded by a regularly rotated battalion of Pakistani infantry. It rules out a special forces attack. Neither your special forces nor ours can just go in and pick him up. Special forces are lightly equipped, highly mobile, and are in no way set up to deal with a well-trained battalion of infantry protecting a high-value target like bin Laden.
So essentially, we do know where he is. You just
absolutely.
essentially told us. All right, Michael Shrimpton, in a moment, we're going to open the lines, which I think is going to be a very, very interesting exercise. No telling what may come up. If you have a question or a comment for Michael Shrimpton, the next hour will allow you to place it. I'm Art Bell.